mentioned, this is being recorded, and our agenda tonight, actually the webinar is brought to you by the Butte Conservation District, Belfouche River Watershed Partnership, and the Bird Conservancy of the Rockies. And we appreciate everybody on this very nice Earth Day taking a little bit of time this evening to get on the Zoom meeting and discuss irrigation and soils and soil health. So with that, getting into our agenda tonight, Val Reeder, who's the NRCS area agronomist, she'll discuss plant water demands. Kent, who's the NRCS area soil scientist, will discuss water movement in soils and irrigation of clay soils. And Dave Ola with the South Dakota Soil Health Coalition will discuss some soil health options under pivots. Then at the end, right now, got to admit some folks. Brad and Laura are joining us. Can you hear us okay?
Yeah, I can hear you good, Justin.
Okay. I'm going to pretty much put everybody on mute. And just as a reminder, okay. Brad, I don't see a mic on yours. Can you hear us at all? Just one moment. There you go, Brad, can you hear us? Okay. Well, we'll just get it going. As I mentioned, this is being recorded. We'll put this webinar on the Belfouche River Watershed Project website. And I just want to thank everybody for taking some time out this evening to join us. And our first presenter will be Val with NRCS. And so Val, go ahead and share your screen and start your presentation.
Okay. It says you disabled participant screen sharing, Justin. So I can't share my screen. So I don't know, because I can't share it.
Kratzky, you're on mute.
Well, I'm a little technically challenged tonight. How many participants? One participant at a time. Who can share? All participants. Who can start sharing when somebody else is? Okay. See if that works. That work?
Yes.
Uh-huh.
Okay. So we'll get this started. Okay. So I'm gonna minimize this so I cannot see myself. Okay, so crop water demands. So that's what my topic is gonna be about. So factors contributing to water demand is the climate, crop type. Okay, that's just kind of like, okay, is it corn, alfalfa, or is it small grains? And then the growth stage that that crop is in, because it's obviously going to use a lot more water when it's in production or reproduction stage than when it first starts out. Okay, so here is the factors that contribute to those climate factors. So temperature, whether it's hot or cool, humidity, dry or humid, windy, and sunshine. And as you can tell from this, most of our climate conditions fall on the high water side. So that's our crop's water demands around here are high. There's this graphic over here that kind of shows what it is, and higher ones cause higher evaporation or transpiration for plants. So to get crop water, you can go to the MesoNet site. This is the general site, and then to get to where it actually talks about the evapotranspiration or the actual water use, you go to this tools and the ag weather, and this is what comes up. So you put in Nisland, that's the one in the district, and 2021, and you push graph. And so this is what came up this morning. So it shows the rainfall that we've had this year, what's the normal rainfall for this time of year, and then how much has grass used to this date from April 1st. So it's used 2.4 inches of moisture. That's what it should use. So, and it used, I looked at the difference from the day before, it was 0.1 inches of rain or moisture that it used. Oh, and that graph website down there is the actual direct link to this graph. So, I mean, this is just a short snippet from April 1st to today, or yesterday, I guess. So this, it doesn't show, because it also shows alfalfa corn and soybeans when they're growing. So this is what last year's graph looked like and all the numbers that it had on it. Okay, so actual rainfall we got last year, a little below what normal is. And then it shows how much each of those crops used throughout the growing season. Grass starts April 1st. Alfalfa, they start recording on May 1st. Corn is May 15th. And soybeans is June 1st. So that's kind of what they're using is the average plant dates for around here. Okay. So according to NRCS, and this is what the peak consumption for all these crops is at the max temperature, say in July, this is how much they're using. So that we help when we design a irrigation system, whether it's a pivot or borders or furrow, whatever it is, we make sure that it meets this peak consumption so that you can deliver that to the crop. Okay, so here's rooting zones or depth, same thing, and then moisture extraction. So it has the rooting depth. I mean, this is the most important part of the rooting depth. I mean, obviously alfalfa goes deeper than 5 feet, but we focus on that top 5 feet. Corn is 4. The other ones are 3. So the moisture extraction over here, so that breaks down the rooting zones in quarters. So if you'll notice that top quarter, and if you use corn, for example, so that top foot on corn is where it gets 40% of its moisture. So that's a lot of it's in that top there. And then the top half is where it extracts the 70% of its moisture. So it's really important to keep the upper half of that rooting zone wet. Okay, so here's about the plant available water. So not all of it is actually available to plants. There is that certain point of saturation where it's like right after it rains, it's sat and it's really rained, it's saturated. And then it brings it down to the field capacity after probably about 24 hours on a typical loam soil, maybe a little slower on clays and a little faster on sands. So field capacity is where we, the optimal, but I mean, you can't always keep it there. So you can allow some depletion, which is about usually 50% of that. And any lower than that, you cause plant stress to the permanent wilting point. And then there's that little fraction that it can only get out when you like bake the soil. So this is where it's not always 50%. I mean, for alfalfa, you can see there, it's 50% is the management depletion level they recommend. But for beans, it's only 40%. So you don't want to go in less than 40% on beans because they're really sensitive. And then small grains are really sensitive in that boot to flowering stage. But then you can let them, small grains dry out a little bit when they're in the ripening stage. Okay, so here's the critical growth stage. This is when you most want to make sure that you have adequate water in your field. So for like alfalfa, it's right after cutting. Makes sense. Corn, the most important is tasseling to grain fill, but really it's important to have adequate moisture throughout the whole thing to get maximum potential. The rest of these is kind of that bloom to boot stage is really important. And then beans are really sensitive to overwatering, and you want to do that last irrigation on milk stage in small grains. Or maybe not quite that late if you're doing for hay, but that's usually when you cut. So why is it important to know how much water you're actually using? Well, I mean, you need to know when you need to irrigate, how much to actually apply, and then you can improve conserving your soil and water, putting either less erosion or putting less water on, and then also reducing that plant stress. So determining when to irrigate. So there's irrigation scheduling methods. These are kind of the ones that the NRCS uses now, but kind of some of them are kind of gone in the past. We're kind of more about the sensors now. I won't go into this a lot because they're going to next week when they talk about the sensors, but the techniques are moisture by feel and appearance. We have a little booklet that tells based on what kind of soil it is, how much moisture it is, what percentage of field capacity is. Then the sensors, little gypsum blocks, and then there's also a checkbook or water balance. You start out at field capacity, and then the crop uses so much ET per day, so you keep subtracting that, but then you can add back in rainfall or when you irrigate again to fill it back up to field capacity. How much irrigation water to apply? Well, I mean, there's formulas to figure that out, and I won't go into that, but this is what in the hot, dry climate of Western South Dakota, kind of from Wall East, this is what NRCS says that the typical average irrigation requirements for each of these crops will be. So alfalfa is 18 on a year like last year. Obviously it was way higher than that because I think it said it used 41 inches and we only got 9. So, I mean, depends on the year and average, what's average. We haven't had an average year here in a while, so. Okay, so improve soil and water conservation. Irrigation water savings. If you actually know how much you're putting on and how much the crop actually needs, you can use less water. Reduce that excess water running off the field. You're not putting on too much water, so it's not running off the end of the field into the drainage ditch and probably eventually either back to some creek or the Belfouche River. Reduce soil erosion. I mean, depending on what type of system you're using, you may still have a little bit, but in general, you'll be moving less water, so you'll be in turn moving less soil with it. Managing salinity. Kent would be better talking about this, but I know that you can manage salinity by pushing those salts down outside of the rooting zone so that they're not close to the surface and evaporating and causing those that white surface. You water it heavy and then pushing it down. Lower soil temperatures. This is more of an under irrigation. So if you under irrigate, then you have higher soil temperatures. If you properly irrigate, you'll have those lower soil temperatures. And then you also have better plant growth. So there's more shading, which also brings the soil temperature just down. Same with less evaporation, they're kind of the same. You have less evaporation from a well-watered soil and you also have better plants to cover that soil. And then you reduce plant stress. So the things that cause from that, more effective nutrients. I mean, that plant is using your nitrogen, your phosphorus, your potassium, all of those out better because it's not under stress. It can pick those up and put them in the grain. You have increased biomass and yield. Yeah, you have a healthier plant, so it produces more. Increase grain and quality size. This is more if you under irrigate, you have a smaller kernel, you have less quality because you don't have the nitrogen being picked up to put that protein into the wheat head. Reduce weed pressure. There's a lot more weeds in a overwatered site. Weeds, I mean, they'll compete. If your plant's not the healthiest, they'll take hold and then they have that extra moisture, so they'll take off. I mean, that's why you have better weed populations and krells and stuff sometimes. Less disease problem, especially root diseases. Yeah, I mean, you don't have that waterlogged soil if you're not over irrigating, so you don't have root diseases such as pythium and some of those. And then your roots also need water. So they just, if you don't have that soil, it oversaturated all the time, there's oxygen that can get into those roots and help that plant be healthier. So questions? I guess that's all I have.
Hey, thanks, Val. And since you got the slide up there, we'll just open it up, see if anybody has any questions at this point. And just unmute yourself over on the lower left of the screen, where I can unmute you if you ask to be unmuted. Or type in the chat if you have a question. Okay.
Okay.
Covered it. So go ahead. Or was there somebody? Nope. Okay. So we'll Thanks, Val. And we'll go on to Kent's presentation. I'm going to go ahead and mute you and unmute Kent. Kent's ready to go.
All right, can you hear me okay?
Yep, you sound good.
All right, I'm gonna take a little time here this evening and kind of briefly discuss some of the high points of how water moves into and through the soil. So when we get a rainfall event, what happens with the water? Well, two things. It can either run off the land, or it can actually move into and through that soil profile. Pretty simple. Now, the process of the water moving into the soil is called infiltration. And runoff occurs basically when the infiltration is low, and infiltration is basically affected by several key factors. And I'm going to briefly touch on several of these that are most important. So, how does the bulk of the precipitation move into the soil? Well, it's through these pore spaces. You see my pointer there? These little gaps between these soil particles, that's the primary means for water to move into and through the soil, is through those pore spaces.
Hold up, Ken. Are you trying to share your screen? You got a presentation?
Yeah.
Yeah, go ahead and you see the green share screen down at the bottom of the screen?
I don't know, something happened. I thought I was sharing my screen. Let me try this again.
I was impressed you were going off of memory there.
Well, I can see my PowerPoint, but for some reason...
So down at the bottom of your Zoom screen, there'll be a green share screen.
Yep, I clicked on that. And then I opened my PowerPoint and you don't see it.
And then you just, you click whatever screen your PowerPoint is on after that comes up. Let me see if there's something I need to...
So when I bring my PowerPoint on up, I can't see that little green button to share the screen anymore.
Go ahead and, there it is, here it comes. So we can see the Zoom screen and now the PowerPoint's coming up. There you
okay.
go, you've got it.
All right. I kind of already touched on those. This is a runoff slide, and there's a soil profile of our Hudec soil, and already discussed how that water moves a little bit through that soil. Infiltration is basically the downward entry of water into the soil surface and or other materials, and like I was mentioning before, there's a number of factors that affect that infiltration and downward movement of water in and through the soil. Now, most of that water movement is through these pore spaces. I can't get my pointer back. Here we go. Can you see my pointer? Basically, those white areas in between these soil particles and aggregates, that's where that bulk of that water will infiltrate and move down in and through that soil profile. Basically, that pore space is that portion of the soil not occupied by inorganic particles like rock, sand, silt, or clay, and organic matter. And the organic matter basically that's in there will allow the passage of water, or it actually can absorb some quite a bit of that water, is depending on the amount of organic matter that's within that particular soil. And of course, this is where the air moves in and through that soil as well. This is kind of a generalized graphic of how much of the soil the pore space is made up of. And it's a pretty much about half. And that's going to vary based on a number of different factors that I'm going to get into here in just a little bit. And ideally, of course, we would like that pore space to be about half filled with water and half filled with air. But of course, that all depends on Mother Nature and whether or not we get rain. Okay, once water gets into the soil, it's primarily affected by two forces, either gravity or capillary action. Gravity, just as everybody knows, pulls everything downhill, right? Even in soil. So gravitational flow is primarily occurs in the large pore spaces when the soil is saturated. And it's relatively rapid if the pores are intact. That means they're connected not only to the surface, but down through that soil profile as well. Capillary action refers to the attraction of water to itself, called cohesion, or to other solid surfaces called adhesion. Water movement may be in all directions, downward, lateral, upwards, even defying gravity. Capillary water basically occurs in the small pores, where those pores are not full of water and water movement is relatively slow. However, this water that is this capillary water is the water that's available primarily to the plants and is trapped in the soil next to the roots of plants. So that's a pretty key mode of action, this capillary action, as far as water getting to plants. Now, the amount and the size of pore spaces are primarily affected by the texture, structure, soil organisms, organic matter, vegetative cover, plant roots and residue on the surface, and finally, the management. I don't have a lot of time to get into these too in depth, but I'm going to hit the main ones here as we go through this. Soil texture is basically the percent of sand, silt, and clay, and has an effect on the quantity and the size of those pore spaces. The more sand there is in that soil, of course, the more pore space there will be. And conversely, the more clay, the less pore space. And those pores in those clay soils tend to be relatively small. This graphic that I'm showing here kind of depicts the relative sizes of the sand, silt, and clay. Another way to think about it, sand you can actually see with your naked eye. Silt particles, you pretty much need a standard microscope. But the clay size particles are actually, you can only see those with an electron microscope. So that maybe puts it into a letter. Little better, I give you a better idea how big these clay particles are. They're very tiny. This is just an example of the textural triangle that we use to assign a textural class to each soil layer. And these soil layers are called horizons. So basically, all inorganic soil particles less than 2 millimeters in size will make up the textural class. And each one of those textural separates, the sand, silt, and clay, should add up to 100%. So I put a little example in here, a soil layer that's got 20% clay and 40% sand. That's all you need to know, is just two out of the three, and then you can determine what textural class that particular soil layer is. And in this case, if we move across at 20% clay, come across and meet, intersect where that 40% sand is, we come right smack in to the middle of the loam texture. So if you ever see a soil description and it's got these goofy names for the texture, this is where this is coming from. Loam is basically equal parts of sand, silt, and clay, to think about it. We determine the texture in the field by what's called the ribbon method, but most of the soil testing labs do have other means of coming up with the textural class of the sample that's set in. Most of the labs, I think, are now using the pipette method, which is a lot more accurate. It will get you within plus or minus 3% of sand, silt, and clay. And the other method is called the hydrometer method, and that's not quite as accurate. It'll get you kind of in the ballpark about 5 or 6% of the sand, silt, and clay. All right, let's take a look at some of the soil texture groupings and some generalized values for water movement, described either as permeability or Ksat. Now, we measure water movement quantitatively based on Ksat, which is a saturated hydraulic conductivity basis where all the pores are filled with water. Permeability is measured qualitatively on the ease in which, like, gases and liquids or plant roots penetrate or pass through a soil. The biggest takeaway from this slide is the higher the sand content, the more water movement will occur, because of course the sand particles, they're rounded and they don't fit well together. There's more pore space, so that allows a much more rapid water movement. If we take a look at the sand and gravelly textures, this RV under Ksat, that's a relative value, that's kind of the mean value, that's greater than 141 micrometers per second, which doesn't mean a hell of a lot to most people, but if you just take that number and multiply it by 0.1417, that'll convert that number into inches per hour. So for these sandy soils, we're looking at almost 20 inches per hour of water movement. Conversely, if we go down, and this is a problem we have in the Belfouche Irrigation District on a lot of soils, these clays and silty clays, that relative value is 0.91, which gives us basically water movement at about a tenth of an inch per hour, which is pretty darn slow. And that's kind of an issue that we have with our clay soils in the irrigation district. As I mentioned previously, the large pore spaces are important for that water infiltration and movement through the soil, and the small pore spaces and our soil organic matter are important for the storage of water in soil. In our clay soils, the lack of large pore spaces really restricts water and air infiltration and movement in and through that soil, thus limiting root growth and activity of, like, beneficial organisms, soil microorganisms, invertebrates, and so forth. And conversely, on these sandier soils, while that water moves through the soil pretty easily, the lack of the small pore spaces limits the soil's ability to hold water and nutrients. So in effect, those sandier soils are pretty droughty and they're not near as fertile and they don't grow quite as well as, especially like our loamy soils. So like I just mentioned, the loam soil basically is a good balance of soil particle sizes. And of course it's best for both the ability of both to move water and yet hold on to some of that water for future future use by plants. Another factor is the soil structure, and it also has a major influence on water and air movement. Basically, soil structure is, it just, you're describing the arrangement of individual soil particles and therefore the arrangement of soil pores between them. It also basically affects the directional movements of water and air through that particular soil. Here's just kind of a graphic depiction of how structure is formed. These individual soil particles basically are aggregated together primarily through the actions of soil microorganisms, gluing those individual particles together to form an aggregate that you see right there in the middle. And the terminology that we use in soil survey, we call these aggregates PEDs. Nice little trivia question if you want to try to stump your friends. And these PEDs, of course, then are arranged around each other, and that gives the structure of that particular soil layer. It's not the entire soil, it's a layer of the soil, because those structures will change from top to bottom. This is just kind of a depiction of some of the more common soil structures we find in our soils in our area. We've got granular structure, and this also kind of, this high permeability that just kind of gives you a broad idea of the qualitative property of that structure as far as air and water movement. So it's pretty highly permeable. Now, an aggregated soil also has high permeability, and it's just these small granulars that are stuck together to come up with these aggregated, or that cottage cheese look that you see in a lot of surface soils when they're in a rain situation. Another very common structure right below the A horizon, or the surface layer, is blocky structure, and it's got moderate permeability, and it's just like the term describes, it's kind of blocky in nature. I mean, it looks like a bunch of building blocks kind of scattered around each other. Over here, we've got columnar and prismatic structure. The columnar structure only occurs in our natric soils or our clay pan soils, and the permeability in those soils that have columnar structure is very low. And in our clay soils, we tend to have prismatic structure where the clay content is the highest, and the permeability through those structures is pretty low. Another structure that we see is called platy structure, and it also has low permeability. And I'm going to kind of describe that here in just a little bit. And finally, there is a massive structure, basically is a soil that is more or less structureless. And we see that in the lowest horizons of soil profiles, what we call the C horizon. This is just kind of shows you the relative ease of which water can move through these different structures. So over here on the left, we got a granular or an aggregated structure. If you can see the water flow pattern, it's pretty much straight down. We get into the blockier structures. There's a little bit impedance of water movement down, but it's still fairly good. However, when we get over here to the right, this is our platy structure, and water's got to move down in a crack, moves along a plate, finds another crack. So this water movement is really, really slow when we look at a layer that's got a lot of platiness to it. So that's not a very ideal situation. And fortunately, we do not see a lot of platy structure unless we're in the Black Hills in what we call E horizon. And same way when we get into depressional prairie potholes over in the eastern part of the state, we get this platy structure in those areas as well. Another thing, I'll talk about that here in a little bit, minute. Management has a big influence on this as well. The next factor that I'm just going to briefly talk about are the biological organisms. First off, I'm going to talk just briefly about earthworms and soil invertebrates. They basically create those big channels that you can see in soil, and those really move a lot of water and air. So it's really imperative that we kind of keep the habitat there for those earthworms, especially, so we can maximize the amount of infiltration and water movement, especially in those clay soils. Earthworms don't like that clay soil real well, but they can survive in those clay soils. And these, I don't know if you can see it very well on my pointer, but these little holes right here are pretty good size holes. We call those macropores. Another factor is the organic matter content in soil, and it has a multiple beneficial properties to the soil organic matter. It's a food source for those microorganisms, and it's, like I mentioned, it's those microorganisms that glue those soil particles together, which basically holds the framework of the soil together, which allows for more and better water infiltration and air and water movement. And organic matter can basically hold about twice its weight in water. So it's huge that we maintain and actually increase our soil organic matter over the last 100 years or so of doing heavy tillage in just about every soil across the country. We've lost at least half our soil organic matter in most of our soils that are under intense agriculture. Vegetative cover is another critical factor. When you look at bare soil, the raindrop basically breaks down the aggregates if that soil is left exposed to that raindrop impact. And it will basically bust up the aggregates, and they will basically go back into their individual soil particle sizes, and that will tend to start clogging those pore spaces. And in time, basically the soil will become crusted, and water infiltration at that point basically ceases, and we see nothing but primarily runoff. Vegetative cover, both living and dead, like we can see in this picture down here, breaks up the impact of that raindrop so we don't get that soil crusting. And that will, in turn, increase the amount of water that we can move into and through that particular soil. We don't get any clogging of those pores because we're not breaking up those aggregates by the impact of that raindrop. And that vegetative cover also can slow down any runoff during those real heavy downpours, giving us more time for infiltration as well. Finally, on the factors, management plays a huge role, and I see it day in and day out, and especially anytime there's heavy tillage. The tillage basically will break down all these soil structures and aggregates, and this little diagram basically kind of demonstrates that. So we have our initial intact soil before any tillage is done. We've got nice exchange of water and air, the CO2 coming off, air movement in, and water movement in. After a primary tillage event, now we start seeing increases in CO2 and evaporation, and now we're starting to decrease the amount of water that we're gonna have in that particular soil. And After a secondary tillage event, we still see quite a bit of evaporation, water loss, and loss of oxygen through that secondary tillage event. Tillage is not good when it comes to movement of water in and storage of water. Just a quick note on compaction. Machinery, of course, the implements and even the hoof action and the weight of animals can compact soils, especially when they are wet. And when that occurs, basically these continuous soil pores are lost or reduced in size, leading to poor water infiltration, slow drainage, and reduced aeration for healthy root growth and nutrient uptake for maximum crop yield. So basically, in short, our compacted soil doesn't provide adequate space for storage of water and movement of air and water within a soil. If you take a look at that picture here on the left, you've got compaction in between the rows, and look where that water is running. Everywhere those wheel tracks are, that's where water is moving down and running off. It's not moving into the soil. And we can have the same impact with cattle when they're concentrated. And I'm sure this is probably around a stock tank, and there's water overflowage, and they basically have stopped all water infiltration primarily through that hoof action and the weight of that particular animal. And it's under these compacted scenarios, the soil structure will actually almost look like it's platy, but it's really not structure. It's just basically the soil being squeezed together and into pretty dense layers, and it almost kind of looks like platy structure, but that is not natural. That's management induced. I was going to talk a little bit more about this in more detail, but I figured as I had so darn many slides, I wouldn't have a lot of time to talk about this. But a major concern that we do have on our soils, irrigated soils, especially in western South Dakota, is soil salinization. Especially on our clay soils with those low water intake rates and low saturated hydraulic conductivities, the potential to bring salts higher up in the soil profile through evaporation and capillary rise is really high in those clay soils. And as that water is moving up, the salts are coming right up with it. So, and this is a bigger concern under sprinkler irrigation. We can't put near as much water on those heavier clay soils that we did when we were under more of a flood irrigation scenario. And it's just really tough to keep that water moving down through that soil profile under a sprinkler irrigation system. And especially with those smaller pores and those clay type soils, it's just really, really difficult to get that water movement down through that soil profile. Another compounding factor that we see in both irrigation districts, both the Belle Fourche and the Fall River, is the irrigation water that's being applied is already moderately high in levels of salts and sodium. So we're kind of compounding the problem with our poor irrigation water, but there is a bright side, and we've kind of proved that over the last 15 years. In order for us to cost share sprinkler irrigation, converting from a flood irrigation to a sprinkler irrigation system, basically what we're requiring people to do is either do long-term perennial alfalfa grass or do no-till. And we're finding out that by doing so, we are not making those soils become saline, which is a bright spot in all of this, because according to our irrigation guide, We are not even supposed to be sprinkler irrigating these clay types of soils. So we found that by doing those two practices primarily, if we're under annual cropping, if we no-till, or if we're under a perennial forage situation, we can get away with doing sprinkler irrigation on those particular soils. That's all I had. Any questions? I know that was kind of a lot, but.
That's good. Thanks, Kent. Does anybody have any questions for Kent at this time? Okay. Well, if not, and if you think of something, go ahead and throw it into the chat. But we'll keep moving. So I'll go ahead and stop hints and you're up, Dave.
Yeah, thanks. Justin, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you pretty good.
I'm going to try to get my screen shared. I don't have much for slides. I'm going to do a little more discussing. Can you see that? Can you see my screen yet?
Something's happening, but I don't see it yet.
Whoops. How about now?
Nothing yet.
All right.
First is I'm a little possessed. At the bottom.
Yeah, I hit that. Try it again. Oh, now it's giving me that choice. All right. How about now?
It's coming. There you go.
It's coming. All right. Let's see. I'm going to share it there. Look good?
Yep.
Okay. Well, good evening, everyone. Most of you know me. My name is Dave Olala, and I'm currently with the South Dakota Soil Health Coalition. I got a part-time gig with them to promote a lot of these soil health practices and was asked tonight to talk about soil health in relation to irrigation. And to give you a little bit of background about me is I was born and raised here on the irrigation project, grew up farming heavy clay soils and tilling the heck out of them until they were dry and then working them down so they're good and tight and compacted, and then we'd try to irrigate them all summer and to poor result in many cases. And when I came back and bought my own farm, I really struggled with some of that and knew that there had to be a better way to make this thing work, because our biggest goal when we're irrigating is trying to get the water into the soil like Kent was talking about. And then some of what Val was talking about as well is keeping it there, but not keeping it there so much that we harm the plant that the plant can actually use it. And those are our big goals with irrigating, because we're in a brittle environment, you know, of 14 to 16 inches of rainfall each year. And so we are taking and replacing the limiting factor that we have with a lack of water. Boy, my thing is really possessed. Anyway, looking at that, how can we get water into this soil and then keep it there to do some good? And those are the biggest challenges out here, because our environment doesn't necessarily lend itself to that in a lot of ways, both as far as climate, but as also with the soils we have out here. You know, many of you have heard me say that a lot of these ground should never have been put under irrigation. And that being the case, I've got my top 10 irrigation issues that most of us have lived with. And I thought I'd just run through them. A lot of those kind of got brought up, but to bring them back, Ken had talked about water sheeting off. That was an issue I always had farming heavy clay soils that I have. They're all class four. They're Kyle clays, some pure shales as well. Work them up, work them down, and then irrigate them. And I could irrigate a field pretty quickly because it doesn't take water too long to get across a field if it's not soaking in. Water infiltrating too fast. That's the opposite thing. And I rent a farm down along the river, and those irrigators have a completely different issue where we're trying on the river, we're trying to fill up all these gravel beds that are down there. And you can use your whole water allotment just trying to get that accomplished. So it's working the other way against us. Obviously, much of what Kent talked about is erosion. We struggle with erosion both in flood irrigation, but we can struggle with that in pivot irrigation as well, in that if we don't have that soil protected, we can bust those particles loose and send them down to the neighbors or down the creek. And then you run into the other thing that Kent mentioned was the compaction or the crusting. Droplets against bare soil are going to compact it, whether it's rain or it's irrigation water. And so if you fill that soil and then you hammer it with water, you're going to compact it, especially the heavy clay. The loamier soils and the sandier ones, you're going to loosen them many times and start them moving. Kent brought up saline issues. Getting too much water and moving that into areas, you create those saline seeps. But in some cases, those are naturally occurring. And I think we make the mistake as farmers to think that we can solve those through tillage or some type of application, and really we can't get that done. Those are naturally occurring saline seeps because this was an old seed bed that was full of salt to begin with. So some of that that's kind of a fool's folly to be even trying to mitigate those. You just got to accept some of that. We create our own saline seeps, like Ken alluded to, by loosening the soil and freeing up the salt, and Val talked about that too. If we can keep that down in the profile, we're going to have less of that at the surface to be flowing with the water to concentrate in many times in the toe slopes. Soil, especially heavy clays, can't touch on. We irrigate that. We get too much water on that soil. Will seal the ground so tight that there is no gas exchange whatsoever. And people don't think about that. We always talk about photosynthesis and plants taking in CO2 and giving off O2 and doing such a great thing, but the opposite action is respiration, and roots have to do that. They have to take in oxygen and give off CO2 to some degree, and if they can't exchange those gases, your plants are not going to perform like they should, and then that's going to attack your bottom line. Then the good old thing of bare ground and sun baking it is evaporation. And there's another challenge. We're trying to keep the water in the ground to do some plants some good, but the sun is trying to bake it out. And you have exposed soil, you're going to do that. And Kent touched on that too. Every percent of organic matter will hold between 20 and 27,000 gallons of water per acre. And if you know your trivia there, 27,000 gallons is equal to 1 inch of water. And if we're trying to do an irrigation and we're letting it all go out, we're going to be spinning that pivot around a lot of times trying to keep up. But if we've got 5% organic matter in there, we've got 5 inches of water that we can hold into that soil profile and do some good. And it doesn't take much math or thought to think, boy, if I can hold the water, I can keep caught up with my irrigation, especially on the sprinkler systems in those hot summers where I'm losing so much, if I'm practicing these soil health practices. Then the other thing we run into is certainly ponding, where we have low spots and we're accumulating water. And many times where we accumulate that water, we're accumulating salts and we're just defeating ourselves there. The other thing that we run into is the temperature of the water can make quite a difference in how it impacts the performance of the plant. And we don't always think about that, but if we're adding hot water to hot ground, where you can be elevating our temperatures. And then Kent touched on the other issue. You start creating ruts in your fields because your soils aren't drying out. And with pivots, if you start losing your soil structure and you're oversaturating, and then you lose what we call the bottom, falls out of your ground, then you're starting to get pivots stuck. And if you're starting to get pivots stuck, you really need to be looking at what you're doing. And so what that all comes down to, it all combines in us trying to hold that water in, get it in, hold it in. And if we don't do that, it creates more expense and poor production and loss in profit. And that serves no one any good. So in talking about soil health, and I came on it by accident in a lot of my practices, just because I was teaching school and had another job, I couldn't spend that time out there farming like everybody else did. I had to start figuring out ways to make that work that took less time. And it came down to some of these principles. And like that first slide talks about, when we look at our farms, we need to look at them as an ecosystem. And there's a lot of pieces that go into that. And so those five principles in this slide that soil health puts out there as foundational will address all those issues that I just talked about. You will mitigate and reduce and hold water, make water useful, reduce the amount of water you have to have, makes your life easier, and then you'll get better performance out of your plants. So I wanted to touch on them. I know if I try to get too deep into these, we'll be here all night, and I know that's not what you want, but certainly to talk about some of those things. I'm having the worst time with my computer tonight. I should have shut it off and not at all. Okay. So the first thing we got to think about is, and I'll touch on this, is the gold standard for soil health is a healthy native rangeland. And we use all that to compare to how we're doing in our cropland soil health, because we're trying to reach the gold standard of what native rangeland looks like. And Kent touched on that, and they've even done some deals. I don't know if Kent's even seen those yet. They put some native rangeland, some soil health soil, and then some conventional soil through a CT scanner down in Missouri. And the native rangeland was just like Kent was talking about. You've got this great balance of about 45% minerals, 5 of which is organic matter, and then 25% water and 25% air. Now, nature did that for a reason, and it kept nature steady to be able to handle the swings of the climate. And if we can go back to that, we'll be able to manage our water a lot better because we've got all that pore space to handle it. And the CT scans show that. That native rangeland looks just like a sponge. The soil health types of croplands look like that, but not as good. And then obviously the conventional till that like Kent was talking about, there's no pore space. You've worked all that out of there. There's no structure to even allow water to infiltrate. And it doesn't take much to show that. And it's an interesting thing about these principles is Dakota Lakes, which you'll see that that website that you can go to, started as a research farm in an effort to figure out how to hold water. And the deal with that was they found out that these practices were the ones to implement to make that work. And so that website's there for you to look at. Let's see if I can get this little. And if we look at these five basic principles of soil health, it's interesting. We think of soil disturbance as just not tilling it, but that also includes chemical disturbance where we can put too much chemical on, whether it's a nutrient or a pesticide, and then also biological disturbance where in a lot of cases on the irrigation project, we bring all this livestock in the winter time down here to this cropland, and then we overgraze it and we compact it and we tread it and we expose the soil, and that in and of itself can be a biological disturbance we don't think about. We want livestock on it, but we've got to manage it like we would rangeland and not overgraze. And so when we think about those things, there's more than just no tilling that we want to consider, and it all goes back to helping hold that water. The second principle, and Kent and I've talked about this a lot, of which one of these five principles is the most important one that you might want to start with to get your soil health going. And we kind of come down to the first thing you have to do is obviously you quit tilling, you quit the disturbance, and that's going to allow you to have cover. And then you're going to work to try to put more cover to armor that soil, and that cover is residue. And there's a lot of different ways you can get residue on the surface. And the irrigation project, because we have that water source and we can produce more forage or more biomass than the native prairie around us, we have an opportunity to jumpstart the biological activity because we can put more biomass residue back down to feed the biology in the soil. And then the thing about residue, it becomes really important, and Kent touched on it. Every time a drop of water, whether it is coming out of the sky or out of a pivot, should never hit bare soil. That should always be a goal. That droplet should hit plant biomass, all that energy slowed down, and then that droplet rolls over underneath that residue and is absorbed into the soil. And if we can get that established, then you really make a whole bunch of leaps and bounds in getting the water in, holding the water, allowing time for the plant to take it in because you're not compacting the soil or you're not creating erosion. And if you haven't disturbed the soil, you have that opportunity because you've got all those pore spaces that the biology, especially like earthworms have done, and dung beetles do the same thing, that allows that soil to absorb that water at a pretty high rate. And some of those folks have some really neat numbers about how many inches per hour that they can pull water into that soil. So you can have some very big rain events and have no ponding of water because the soil structure is such that it can bring that in. How are we doing, Justin?
We're getting there. So if you want to, I'll give you a minute or so to wrap up. Okay.
And then we look at the other thing that we have an advantage out here on these irrigation projects is that we raise a lot of alfalfa, and having a perennial in your rotation keeps a live root in the soil year round. And that becomes a really big deal in the soil biology functioning with the plants. That's where the cover crops come in. Anytime you don't have a cash crop going on, if you can have a cover crop growing in there, we don't have an issue about it necessarily taking water away from us, as many times we might want it to pull some water away. And in that case, cover crops can let that happen. The one thing we mess up with perennials is many times we run in monocultures, and alfalfa is a good example of that. And so you're there's just way too much diversity in biology that if you run monocultures, you're giving up something. And deep tap-rooted plants like alfalfa serve a purpose, but then you also need those fibrous-rooted plants on the surface to help hold the water, or help hold the soil, and also utilize excess water. And so we want to think about that when we look at a lot of our plant diversities, that we have warm season grasses, warm season broadleaves, cool season grasses, and cool season broadleaves. And then the last thing that we should think about, and we're already doing it on the irrigation projects, is most of us have integrated livestock. It's just that we do it overgrazing, and we really need to really look at, utilize that livestock, allow them to cycle those nutrients, put that organic matter, or already start that decomposition of the residue and speed that up. And then that will become organic matter to help better hold our soils. And so that kind of wraps it up. I know I can go a lot longer on a lot of those topics, but the Soil Health Coalition website is there. My contact, my email, and my phone number's there. So certainly if anyone wants to visit, I'm always available to do that. And if you have any questions, I would gladly entertain any of those now.
Anybody have any questions for Dave? Okay. Thank you, Dave. Appreciate it. And now I'll go ahead and stop your video. Dwight, can you hear me?
There. Can you hear me now?
Yep.
Okay.
We can hear you, and I'm putting you on the video. So, yeah, if you would just want to take about 10 minutes and share with us some of your experience with irrigation and soil health within the Belfouche Irrigation District.
Okay. I'm a North Dakotan. Moved here 31 years ago. I'll be here 32 this year. The biggest thing in our operation when I moved here, I was used to heavy soils in the Richardton, Hebron area. And so this wasn't a real big change in how the soils are tight, what you do with it. But the thing that was really dramatic for me was the amount of organic matter we didn't have in the soil. And we were like 1.7 31 years ago, and tried a lot of different things. And we had a field, some of our fields this year at 0 to 6 inches or 4.3, and 6 to 12, we were 3.4. And that's been a dramatic change. We've done a lot of what a lot of these guys are talking about, the grasses, alfalfa, just anything to build organic matter and then take as much manure out there as we can have available. But we've flood irrigated for a long time. And then we were able to acquire a couple of pivots. And the big thing with the pivots that I find is I understand everything about the salinity that Kent was talking about. But the big thing, what I seen is if the more production, the more plant mass you can get and grow, where at the beginning of our fields where the water came out and we flooded, we didn't have much growing there. Then at the end of our fields, that was flooded out as well, nothing growing there. By having the pivots, we're growing on all of the field. And by doing that, we increased all this plant material, and we're able to, I don't plow, used a roller packer for the first time this year, but I don't believe in doing all that tillage and stuff. So we do a lot of planting right into stubble. We don't even own a no-till drill, but we just go into it. And once we get that ground broke up, the other thing that we've done is go right into alfalfa ground. We wait in the spring. I spray it out in the spring. We'll try to get 10, 11 inches of growth, go in and put corn in. And so the water isn't hitting that ground like those guys are talking. But the big thing is we can still irrigate that corn up. Like on a year like this, 2017, those years, we wouldn't even have a corn crop if we weren't able to pivot irrigate. So those are huge advantages. And therefore, you're getting a crop where a lot of these years you're getting a third of a crop, and it all boils back down to your organic matter. The more you can put on there, the better off this heavy Kyle terrace clay soil will work. And so that's pretty much what we've been doing. The cover crops are huge. They told me you need to grow something all the time. Well, the radishes and the turnips have really worked well up here. We run sheep operations, so we're able to utilize some of the grazing. Dave really touched on something, not to overgraze, because that hoof action, you loosen it up. So you got to have a place to move them, get them off of there, eat about a third of it, move them off. The thing we fight up here is deer. And those things have really caused havoc in our area. I can't keep them out. And that does create a problem for us. But that taproot of that radish is huge in breaking up a lot of that compaction. So I've touched on a lot of things. I think that's about 10 minutes, maybe not, but that's kind of what's happened in the short period of time I've been out here. Overwatering, as to me, is that flood water creates more of a salt problem than I think we really realize. I think those pivots are actually a better deal than what they're led to believe. The thing of it is, you can't get hail. You got to produce when you own one. So there's all those things you have no control of, and that's how things go out here. Thank you. Is there any questions?
Yeah, thanks, Dwight. I appreciate that. Any questions for Dwight? Okay. We've got a couple of chat questions, but I'm going to go ahead and I'm going to go ahead and go to Brad first. Or Brad here is going to back clean up and try to have Brad tell us about his experience with irrigation and soil health. Can you hear me, Brad? Okay. I don't think anybody can. My microphone seems not to work, is what he just typed. Yeah. Other than that, other, you could be a really soft talker too, Brad. I don't know. But, okay. Let me try to mute you and unmute you again and see if that, see if it prompts your microphone. Try that, Brad. It shows your microphone is on my display. Okay. Well, with that, I think we'll try to go ahead and go to the questions. If Brad wants to chime in on any of the questions or put in anything into that chat box, I can sure read it for him. So I'll go to the questions real quick. Ooh, there's a lot of discussion. Okay, our first one, and this is probably for, I'm going to put Dave and Dwight on the spot because I know Alex is an East River farmer over there. So when determining irrigation amount, how much of a factor does plant population play in that? And then Valerie had responded, the higher plant population will result in higher irrigation amounts as there is more plants extracting water from the soil, typical plant populations are higher on irrigated than dry land. So I'm going to go ahead and unmute Dave and Dwight. And Brad, keep working on your microphone. See if you can get that working while we answer these questions. So yeah, Dwight, you want to take that one first?
Yeah, I can touch on it. Yeah, absolutely what Val said. When you put a lot more plants in there, it's no different than putting a bunch of livestock in an area. They're going to utilize more water. So like Dwight touched on too, back to the organic matter deal, it's how much you can hold in there that's available for the plants. You can have a lot of water in the ground, but if the saline's so high that the water is unavailable, it doesn't do any good. And increasing the plant population, unless it's a plant that can take in a lot of salts, is not going to serve you very well. So it goes back to understanding what you've got for a soil analysis for organic matter and what types of soils you have and their ability to hold the water and make it available for the plant. And that's going to take some trial and error then. Obviously, every year is different. You know, temps of days, growing degree days, those all come into play and you have to keep track of that. And that's where the irrigation water management helps to know what you have available in the soil to begin with. And then you can add back to that. Dwight, you got anything else to add to that?
Well, the interesting thing, Dave, I didn't really talk about, but we have been adding quite a bit of sulfur and that helps the plant utilize a little more moisture, I think. And then that plant population is interesting because in this area, we did everything from 28,000 to 36,000 on corn. And the 36, I'll produce the 28 every time. And I don't know that there was that much difference in water use. We had the soil monitors and same field next to each other. I didn't see much difference. It's probably crazy, but we didn't see it in those soil monitors.
What was that, a wet year or dry year?
That would have been a pretty dry year. Would have been about 2016, 17, right in there. But
that's an interesting thing.
I can't explain it. I know the yield was almost 30 bushel difference in the high plant population versus the low. We had big ears on the low, but not enough of it.
Well, I can give you some maybes. If you've got that ground shaded and you've got residue, then you've got a more uniform climate. It's not going to move up and down. And you may have been providing a climate for that higher population just because of all the canopy cover and then the microclimate that you created. And then if you've got your biology working, like the Solvita test would suggest, then you're going to have the biology providing more nutrients, and those plants were there to take it up.
Well, and my son Josh thought that corn with the high population was developing its own little climate in there.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying.
Yep.
Good question. I'll go to the next one. Thanks, Dave and Dwight, on that. Our next one is, if you have a soil compaction problem in your field, what's the best management practice to treat that? So, Kent, I think you're unmuted. So I know you responded in chat, but go ahead and tell us again how you answered that.
Well, basically, when it comes to soil compaction, plant roots do the best job to alleviate that soil compaction. I see a lot of producers that'll go in and do more tillage to try to break up that compaction, and it really doesn't do much good whatsoever. The problem is with tillage, you basically break up all your soil structure, so you're left more or less with those individual soil particles, and they're easy to compress just with the weight of the tractor or the drill or whatever that you have out in your field. So going to a perennial system or use of cover crops, I mean, anything you can do to put plant roots in the ground and living plant roots for that matter, to try to help build back some of that soil structure is always the best thing that I always recommend. Any thoughts, Dave?
Yeah, an aha moment that I had, because Dwayne Beck always made me think a lot. And so you think, okay, compaction and trying to get things in. So I need that big chisel. I need that turnip or that radish to do that. But that's exactly the wrong way. Dwayne said you use a fibrous plant. So when you're trying to figure out plants, and especially like cover crops to help break that up, you need grass plants that put a lot of small roots up there. He says, when you go to chisel something out, you don't start with your biggest chisel, you start with your smallest one, and you start to get the crack form, and then you can use a bigger chisel. So I kind of got that then, and so putting in TEF is one of them. Rye does a great job, maybe ahead of some of the others, but almost any of those cool seasons will do that well. But the millets and the sorghums, especially after a cutting or a grazing, will shoot out even more root hairs and break up a lot of that compaction.
Okay. Thanks for that input. Anybody else want to add to that?
I think I'll mention one thing maybe, and none of this compaction happened overnight, and there isn't going to be any one cure-all where if you start doing it tomorrow, it's going to go away. It's going to take time to heal it, just like it took a little bit of time to get it compacted. So anything, if you're starting to work on it, you just need to be patient with it and go from there.
Thanks, Justin. Well, with that, I just want to say thanks to everybody. Sorry, Brad, we couldn't hear you, but we have another chance. Probably, I'm going to show my screen here as a reminder. If everybody can see that. Our next webinar is Thursday, May 20th at 7 to 8 p.m. I'll send out an invite to that, and you'll need to register and go through all that again, but I'll keep sending out reminders. Brad, if you get your microphone figured out, I'll put you on that panel too. Talk soil health and moisture sensors and all the good stuff. And I just wanted everybody to think also, really what we wanted to do as the end or the finale for this effort is to do an irrigation project tour this summer. And so everything's looking like June is getting busy and kind of filled full up, but certainly July, I'm looking at some dates, and we would like to go out in the field and invite everybody that's participated and go around to look at some of those projects and actually see what everybody's been talking about, not only on this webinar, but the one in March and the one that we'll have in May about irrigation scheduling. So if anybody has a good site, just feel free to let me know. Send me an email, or my phone number is 605-877-2134. And with that, I think we've just about hit 8:30. Just want to say thanks to Alex, and don't know if there's any other East River folks, but sure appreciate them hanging on this late this evening, and everybody else taking times to do that. So, and I'll just, there's a chat in here. Paul added that oats work best for us to loosen the soil. So there's another option there for you. So before we go, any other questions? Okay. Once again, thanks for your participation tonight. Look forward to next month when we do this again, if possible. And certainly if you don't make that one, really we'd like to have you part of the irrigation project tour probably in July. So other than that, everybody have a good evening. Good night.